Hello, welcome to True Hoop with me, Gerard Hector and Henry Abbott. How are you, sir?
Good, thank you. How are you?
I'm excellent. And we have Sports Illustrated editor and author of Mind Game, Julie Kligman. See, here's her book. And it's out today, folks. Today, March 5th. Julie, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
We are excellent. So we're super excited to have you on. I will have to say this. So Henry just finished the second draft of his book was submitted. So he is not where you are, which is, oh, this baby is printed out the door. But I feel like he has some commonalities, some kind of feelings about he wants to share with you right now.
No, I just have like, first of all, congratulations. I mean, holy smokes. How long were you working on this thing?
Few years.
Yeah. So, and the fact that we're talking to you on the actual day, like I feel, does it feel like your birthday? Does it feel like it's a big deal, right?
It does kind of feel like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited to be talking to you today. That's really all I want to say at this point is I have talked to so many authors for so many podcasts through the years and always been a little blasé about like, oh, you got a book, but not my view anymore. My view now.
Yeah.
You have wrung the marrow from life and put it into this project. And I want to honor that work because I understand. Actually, I did notice that you thanked the coffee shops in Queens where you spent your time. Like,
yes,
totally get that. This is where you, this is where you spilled the blood, right? Like, just like, oh, we got to do all this work. Yeah. So congrats.
And
thank
Henry,
you so much.
You also loved her dedication right at the top of the book, which
that's
I thought
badass.
Pretty
that's
badass.
So badass. It wasn't like, this is for my dog. It wasn't like, this is like for my mom. It was, do you want to read it?
To the psychiatrist who told me I'd be dead by now. I'm not. Well.
Julie, what the fuck?
Look, I've seen a lot of bad psychiatrists, some worse than others, obviously. And I just, you know, I was having trouble coming up with a dedication. But I still think about how angry I was at that time and just like, fuck that guy.
I didn't even know. I thought that was like probably the first day of psychiatry school. It was like, never say this to anyone. Mm-hmm.
Right? Yep. You would think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well,
that didn't work out so well. So obviously, in many ways, well, yes, we're happy you're here. But that, I'm sure, had some motivation in spurring you on to write this phenomenal book. And, you know, this is such a complex topic and talking point and issue. And I really wanted to start out because your foreword was written by former WNBA player Leisha Clarendon, who is transgender, an activist, but so much of her foreword was just about the struggle that an athlete goes to just to try and make it, right? Like just forget about like the day-to-day, all right, I made it, now I have to like grind through the season just to make it. And there is this disconnect between the athlete as a whole human, who also has feelings, who also, right, has other things going on. And it seems to be sort of running contrary to what we, as the larger we, not us three enlightened people on this show, but the larger we in this society think about sports, right? Which is, this is just, we grind, you're a superstar, you do whatever, right? All super aggro and like, and it's like, this is really weird. Like, why do we do this thing? So why do we do this thing, Julie?
I mean, I think we have a tendency, again, not us three, everyone.
You would never.
To kind of, no, we're perfect.
Perfect, yeah.
I think society has a tendency to put athletes on pedestals. I think it's comforting to be like, oh, here's this person or this group of people I can root for who are like immune to everything, who are perfect. Who never experience any challenges they can't conquer. I think it's really soothing to have that kind of presence in your life. And I think that's one of the reasons people watch sports. But, you know, it's so harmful, obviously.
Yeah, extremely harmful. And I love, again, just how the book starts because it's her story, right, of trying to make training camp that year with the Minnesota Lynx, which she eventually doesn't end up doing, but how she breaks out into a rash and like all these various things are happening to her. And it's probably her body having a physiological reaction to, yeah, this shit that you do every day, not good for you, right? Like,
totally.
That coupled with everything else going on in your actual life outside of the hardwood, combination, yeah, this is all bad. So I know people love cheering and you love it and it's great, but this is all bad. And this is my way of rejecting you or rejecting it and telling you bad. let's address some problems we have here.
Yeah, I was really glad Leisha was game to write the foreword because I'm non-binary myself. And so to get a fellow trans person to write the foreword and, you know, let alone one of Leisha's stature in the game and, you know, in sports and in the world was just incredible. And yeah, like you said, I feel like they did such a good job of laying out like what it takes to not make it, just to survive.
Yeah. And it's, and Henry, we talk about this in the NBA all the time. It's not just, all right, I make it whatever. Every day and every year, someone is trying to take something from you once you get there, right? Whether it's minutes, whether it's contract dollars, whatever it is. So it's, so you have this fight flight response on the one hand, right? Predatorial things coming at you to take away the thing you've worked so hard to do. I've got to hold on to it and fight sometimes my teammates, not literally, although sometimes in some sports people do fight their teammates literally, right? To stop them from taking the thing from you. And also, again, I have to manage myself and deal with my, I'm having a fight with my partner. We have a mortgage due. We got kids who are whatever in school. And I just think we seemingly have gotten to a place where we're willing to talk about those things, but we're so far away from being, you know, ready to actually have mature conversations about it as a society. But we're moving in the right direction, right? I think so.
Yeah. I mean, the past 5 or 10 years, especially, there's been progress. It's very slow, but there is progress. Yeah.
My last half hour included like these two little things that seem relevant. Like one was, we're about to publish a story about Tyrese Halliburton has just had a really rough week. Like he's not doing the things he normally does. Maybe he's exhausted. Maybe his hamstring hurts. But like you can see on video, he's just like, the Pacers are losing every game because they count him so much. And so like, imagine being Tyrese, right? You're like, I just need to be like the best version of myself today. And that's not enough. You have to like understand yourself better, right? How to motivate that. At the same time, I've been texting with Katie Heindel of basketball. And like, she's writing a book too. We've been a little bit like, book buddies a little bit, and she's like, you know, she's like, I'm really fighting this thing where like I feel like I need to like write every day, and I need to like be productive every day, and I was like, that's probably exactly how Tyrese is feeling too, right? Like, yeah, they both have this thing, and it's probably how you get a rash in training camp, right? It's like that same exact like, yeah, it's supposed to be actually like, I'm gonna zip ahead. We're pretty organized here, Julie, but I'm gonna zip right ahead to Naomi Osaka had an incredible idea, I thought, which is, just athletes should get to have an unexplained sick day now and again.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. Mind blown. Right. Like,
I mean, we have it all the time, right? In our lives. I don't have to, I mean, yeah. I'll tell Henry, I'm not feeling okay. It's like someone else do the pod. Like, right. It's easy.
Yeah. You want to have a press conference when your dog dies? Like, I don't think so. You know what right, I mean? Like,
definitely
right,
not.
Right.
No.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people ask me how I feel about that idea because, you know, as a journalist, you want access to players. But I think you want players to also be present and feeling like they're capable of giving good answers. So if you were able to take a sick day every time, like, screw that, especially if like you lose in the finals of a major tournament or something like that. Like, I think you should have to show up then. But yeah, every once in a while, if you want to skip out because you genuinely feel like it would be harmful to you, I think that's a good thing.
You know, I love that because as an avid tennis watcher and someone who's gone to a U.S. Open a number of times covering it and tournaments, I thought what Naomi Osaka said was brilliant. But then you have the sort of opposite of that, right? Which is, so she, in my mind, is a good messenger, right? Mm-hmm. But then you have Kyrie Irving, who is probably not the best messenger to say, I need time off, right? Because right. He'll take an unexcused absence. And first of all, the team didn't even know because he didn't tell them, right? So in that way, you're being not accountable to your teammates and the people who employ you, right? So it's this weird sort of dichotomy and balance we have within sports where I'm all for athletes having what they need. But at the same time, right, there needs to be some level of like check and balance where it's like, dude, you can have time off, but you can't just disappear and not tell us. You're not coming to work today, right? Let us know. Fine. Okay. All good.
Yeah, completely. And I think there's a weird thing too with like I get into this a little bit in the book, but with like someone like Ben Simmons, you know, it's not like he disappeared. He did say like mental health when he was with the Sixers. But there's a lot of like fan distrust around that. Mm-hmm. And I think mm-hmm. even teammate distrust around mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. And it's like, so what I was looking at was like, well, what do you do in that situation? I personally think you have to err on the side of like believing the person, but it's still really tricky.
Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head with teammate distrust, right? Because not only do you have teammates who either will say something innocuous or benign about where the person is, you also have people who cover the sport, right? Former athletes who are in many ways seen as, well, if they say it, then it's true, right? If mm-hmm. they say it's a bad idea, all the credibility is lost, right? I think about Henry when Adam came out, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, with where he was very concerned about the NBA players and their level of happiness and everything throughout the season. And then, of course, Charles Barkley gets on TNT. He's like, these guys make $50 million a year and fly all over the world. Who's unhappy? It's like, oh, please stop right. saying shit like that. You're not helpful in this moment at all.
Also, you are a self-confessed alcoholic. Like, I mean, right. like, we can't pretend that everything's just hunky-dory, right? Like, why did you drink totally. So much, Charles? Like, what was going on there? Were you feeling a little delicate, not yourself? You know? we've all been there, buddy. Like, it's okay.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, right? The permission to not be okay. And it's what you talked about at the top, right? It is comforting to... Again, not us, but most people to know these athletes are impervious. They're impervious to everything. They're superhuman. Everything's great because it makes us feel better about ourselves if they're that way. Mm-hmm. Because mm-hmm. if they reveal they're not doing well, well, that means, well, shit, maybe I'm not doing well. Right.
Right.
And then right. I don't want to deal with that.
Totally. And like you can have all this money and all this fame and, you know, it doesn't buy your mental health.
Not at all. Yeah. Every rock star story has this. Oh, whatever. You're like every movie star, like, right. We know this super well. Right. Like,
yeah.
And they don't even like, you know, like athletes, I think it has the veneer of health, right. Generally, like they're supposed to, they kind of look like, but they don't live very long. They don't like, certainly NBA players don't, right. Like it's not actually mm-hmm. healthy. It's pretty extreme. Right. It's, you know, so Adam Silver talked to Sloan about this, like, you know, he had a superstar, tell him that he would like land in a city, put his headphones on, go to his hotel room, like, you know, play a game, leave the city and not really have meaningful conversation with anyone. Right. And like, like, well, I mean, you've been marinating in mental health talk for like, that's not good. Right. I mean, this isolation is not helpful.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty concerning to hear. But it's not surprising to hear either. I think, kind of Adam is right to be concerned about all this. It's just, I don't know. The things we put these people through are, like you said, extreme.
And it's also sort of what you mentioned at the beginning, putting them on a pedestal, right? Okay, so it's how we sort of lionize and valorize them. And then it's okay, I'm a super, so they can't do normal things, right? Like mm-hmm. they can't just, all right, I'm gonna go to place X and just have dinner. And like, no, because then 1,000 people, particularly if they're like, you know, well known, right? Like they're gonna all run up to them and like all be in their face. And it's like, okay, this is not normal. I can't do this. And, or that it's like, right, Henry, and we know this from the NBA style, right? Well, then you're flying in women from wherever who you don't have actual relationships with, right? It's all transactional, right? And it's just all of it is bad. And the only actual communication you're having is with teammates. And that's a very for a specific thing, right? Imagine like your job. These are the only people you talk to all day, 24/7. Like, okay, I like my coworkers, but is this what I really want to be all the time? It's mm-hmm. just, it's not healthy and productive. But the masses, I don't think, want to hear that story, right? Because again, it reminds them of, well, this is my life. And, you know, you get the whole, well, I want to separate from my terrible day. I want you to just show up and entertain me for 2 hours and then worry about your own time on your own time. And it's like, guys, we need compassion there somewhere, you know?
Yeah, it's like, oh, yeah, I just want to dissociate from my terrible day. And yeah, but no, it's we need to see these people as people. And I think some of the problem is athletes don't always see themselves as full people either.
Go on.
Yeah, say more.
Yeah. So there's something in like psychology circles called identity foreclosure. And there's a specific term called athletic identity foreclosure, where growing up, especially if you are really good at sports and you kind of put all your eggs in the athlete basket, you might not be able to see yourself as a full person. You might just say, like, I am an athlete. That's who I am. And it might work out when you're young and you're beating up on the competition, right? But if you get to an elite level of sport, that's likely to stop pretty quickly. And so then it's like, if you're failing as an athlete, you feel like you're failing as a person.
Oh, that's so interesting. There's a Jackie McMullen did like this big story with Ben Simmons when he was struggling a little bit. And basically she paraphrased it as like, you know, he's just used to getting an A on every test, right? Like, and like he, at that point, the question was, why won't he shoot threes? And she was like, he can shoot them in practice and he makes like 40%, but he wants to shoot when he makes 45%, right? Like he just wanted to be like absolutely exceptional at it. And that's a, you could like, once you told me that, I saw his, I feel like I saw a little bit, I'm not diagnosing him. I don't know if that's what he had, like, but I felt like, I was like, oh, he feels worthless unless he's perfect. And like, as an athlete, right? Like, and then that's when I started to get mad. Like this, I feel like the Sixers fans like just didn't get the most out of him, right? Like, I feel they were like, oh, you're a little tender. You're a little weak. Like, get the fuck out of here. You know, like, and I'm like, guys, he actually would be really helpful to you. Like, if you would be nice to him.
You know? And then it's almost as though fans see it as an affront, right?
Oh, it's a macho culture. It's right? A macho, like, culture.
It is such an affront. How dare you have feelings or be vulnerable about something? Like, this is a problem, right? And I don't like it. Right? And
I feel like they're saying, like, how dare feelings be central? Like, your feelings are part of this. And then every super macho person at some point, like, reaches a certain age or has a certain life experience, then they're like, I just want to be honest and tell you it was my feeling. It's like, we knew all along, buddy. Everybody has feelings. Like,
right.
Like, that's not a surprise.
We knew. We knew.
Oh, you have feelings too.
Oh my God.
It's almost, you know, like you're a human being. Like, yeah.
In Osaka's case, I thought she, you know, her story, I think, was among the more interesting ones, because here you have someone who, you know, she's very upfront and open about it. Serena Williams was her tennis idol, right? Like, growing up, right? Mm-hmm. She beats her in a U.S. Open final, which in many ways should be the happiest moment of her life, right? But it so wasn't, right? And not only from beating the idol, but the boos from the crowd who didn't want her to beat Serena, and then all the emotions she had, right? Because she already had conflicting emotions to begin with. Oh my God, this person who's amazing, who I look up to, I just beat her in this amazing tournament, like. So that's, I got to deal with that. But wait, these people don't want me to win. Why? And then all of a sudden, I'm now seen as, oh, well, you beat the greatest player of all time. So now you're going to be the greatest player. Whoa. Like, that's not how this works, right? No.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. And now you got to do press conference. You got to do, I'm not equipped to handle this right now. And the vitriol that began because it was Serena and what she faced, and people being like, well, clearly you're not tough enough and you can't make it. And it's like, it's not about tough enough, right? It's about where she is and her feelings in this moment.
It's like, in a way, that moment really showcased that we learned nothing from the way we treated Serena herself.
Pretty much.
I mean, it's pretty fucking sad. Like, I don't know. It's been how many years since Serena came on the scene? And
Correct. We're
still treating female athletes that way. We're still treating black athletes that way. Mm-hmm. It's wild.
Yeah.
Can you tell the story of Sha'Carri Richardson?
Mm.
So Sha'Carri Richardson is, you know, one of the great sprinters of our time. So she was disqualified from the Olympic trials. Yeah. Because she had been smoking pot and tested positive for that. She was mourning a death in her family and kind of using it to blow off steam, I guess, using it as a mental health kind of way to cope. And I don't know, it's really interesting. The experts I talked to for this book in the substance use chapter are kind of like, well, maybe pot isn't that bad. And it's like, yeah, thanks. That's what the rest of us think too.
Well, it's super confusing, right? Like it's years ago, I interviewed NBA people about performance enhancing drugs. And I talked to this one super elite trainer and he was like, it's like just the way stats work. He's like, I work like basically 100% of the elite NBA players I work with smoke pot. He's like, so I assume it's performance enhancing because otherwise how could it be that all the best players in the world use the same drug? And I was like, oh, that's a fucking mind fuck right there. But, and then actually Bill Walton's buddy wrote a story about how basically like the athlete's life is so overstimulated that like anything that makes you able to just like relax,
calm,
like, is helpful. You did a lot of good reporting on just like this topic of like, where are we? Like, why is it banned for Shakari Richardson anyway? Right. Like, and then, you know, does it help? Does it hurt? Like you kind of, I thought you had an interesting collection of just like views here. If you could just talk a little more about what you learned.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think anyone has found any evidence that it's performance enhancing. To the comment you got from the trainer, I would kind of be like, well, then why do so many athletes drink? Like, that's not performance enhancing. I don't think anyone would argue it is. Yeah. But yeah, I think like, yeah, it helps people relax. That's not performance enhancing. It might bring out like, I think the jury's still out as to whether it like could exacerbate feelings of depression or anxiety in the long run, even though it feels like in the moment, like it's helping. So I think the experts I talked to would largely caution athletes about using it for those reasons. But at the same time, it shouldn't be this highly stigmatized substance.
Yeah, it feels a little to me like, I mean, after Malice in the Palace, there was a lot of like examination in the NBA about just like, how red state America views the NBA and like, you know, black players going into stands and punching white people is like, lit some cultural trash fire or something. And, and like, and then so suddenly they have to wear button down shirts because we need to placate these people who are nervous about this. And it's like, I feel like marijuana is just like, my personal take is that I don't even think the league cares about marijuana at all. Their program is super soft. The testing is super soft. Like you can fail 550 tests in a row and no one would even know. That's an exaggeration. But they just need to look like, if you look like you're permitting marijuana, it offends some fans, right? I feel like that's what it feels like to me, right? Shakari Richardson is supposed to look like someone, she's supposed to talk like someone who wouldn't just smoke pot because her mom died, right? She's supposed to be like, somehow more goody two shoes than that or something, or I don't know. Like, is that fair?
I think that is fair. And it goes back to what I was saying about like putting athletes on pedestals and seeing them as role models and these like perfect people. And yeah, I just think that's kind of silly.
Shakari talked about it, you know, where she said, you know, do you know what it's like to have to perform in public in front of people when you are grieving or going through something and to have to tamp my feelings down and not show them because, again, to Henry's point, somebody in a red state in the middle of the country has to feel comfortable about you. Like, fuck your comfort. Like, you know what I mean? Like, what? Like, why does that matter? Like, I'm not comfortable right now at this moment, you know?
She just needs another soccer sick day.
Yeah, pretty much.
Actually, yeah.
Except she won, right? She won those trials.
She sure did.
She did, yeah.
And I just saw her not been... and she's back. And if, by the way, like, right now, ripped. I don't know
if you guys have seen her. She's tearing it up right now. I'm like, yeah, you guys, I think you were obviously wrong because she's fine. Like, she's really good.
She was kind of slight back when this happened, but not anymore. Like, you know, Shakari's back and she is going to kill somebody. Like,
no, she should be crushing this summer in Paris for Team USA for sure. Olympic trials will be in Oregon again in June, I imagine, sometime around then. I love all of this stuff. It is so fascinating, and it takes me back to a part of the book, truly, where a hypnotist who has no actual medical degrees in anything was maybe the person who started the whole idea of having sports psychology as a thing and teams doing it. What? Tell us about this hypnotist.
Oh my God, I love this part of the book so much. It might be my favorite little part. I'm like sitting in New York Public Library, like reading this guy's memoir from 1951, and I'm like, what is happening here? So this guy's name is David F. Tracy. A sports psychology historian called him kind of a flim-flam artist, which is an amazing quote. So this guy, he wasn't the first sports psychologist to embed with a team. He was the second. The first was Coleman R. Griffith, who worked with the Cubs in the late 1930s. And then this guy, David F. Tracy, he worked with the St. Louis Browns, the baseball team. Mm-hmm. He was a hypnotist. He seemed pretty aware at the time that the team might have been doing it for the headlines and not to actually have him help the players. He was eventually like forbidden from talking to the team during the game, which I think says a lot. But yeah, he would just like hypnotize guys. And like, I mean, hypnosis is something that is kind of still used today, but in a much different way. Like, I talked to someone for the book who uses hypnosis, and it's more like teaching them self hypnosis techniques and like setting intentions and, just giving people more control over their own minds. And she joked like, yeah, it's not like you see, you know, I always tell people like, if you see athletes like clucking like chickens around noon every day, that's my doing. Like, it's not, yeah, it's not like that
chicken thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
But, this guy, I think, was more toward the chicken clucking end of the spectrum.
But that's it's so interesting because that obviously the teams that the Browns use it for sure for headlines, because you can see in the book you describe like the owner, the coach, the GM like brought their wives like, oh, you're going to hypnotize us all one by one. Because back then that was what hypnosis is, right? Get on stage and when I blink my finger or snap my fingers, you're going to all of a sudden cluck like a chicken or do whatever. But ultimately, as you pointed out, it is about calming your state of mind, right? So that because we had. Who do we have on, Henry, talking about this, where athlete performance, it's about mind state, right? Where they are and the clarity allows them to perform like at a certain level. And I think even David F. Tracy said in the memoirs, you quoted him, Julie, it's not about turning a 220 hitter or a 300 hitter. It's about a person who's already talented enough to hit 300 that I have him in the right frame of mind so he can hit 300.
Right. And I actually think that is a very useful way of looking at sports psychology, is like, it's not going to totally transform you. It's gonna like tweak the edges of your game and make sure that you're capable of living up to your potential.
Also, I feel like, you know, how many different circumstances can you be you in, right? Like, if, you know, we just talked about Shakari Richardson having a death in the family, like, and then she freaking did win, you know, like, with, right. Like, you know, she can do her thing with even with that craziness, right? Or, you know, maybe you're getting a rash in the Lynx training camp and your anxiety is grabbing you in a way that makes you unable to perform, right? Like, that would be totally understandable, right? Like, I feel like maybe this is where the psychology part comes in, is like, you know, the thing that would rattle the circumstances, like how many different circumstances can you cope with and still just kind of like go to work, right? And maybe you can expand the list, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's sort of a balance here, right, between mental health and performance, right? And I feel like that sort of, because as a coach myself, when I coach in high level, like swimmers who try to qualify for senior nationals, Olympic trials, things of that nature, so much of it was about, when we would dabble into this area, was about performance, right? How do I make it so that you are performing well? And not, and this was in the, you know, early to mid 2000s, not thinking, but should I be leading with wellness first, right? And this is, I'm a 20-something year old, know nothing about it, right? Like, but like, should I be leading with how are you doing first, right? And those factors to then figure out, are you even in the right place so that we can begin to optimize you for performance, right? And that's that balance of human being versus we have this stated goal and mission that we have to achieve, which is you doing this thing, right? And who should be in charge of that, right? Because Henry and I certainly agree, it damn sure shouldn't be the teams, right? They're not the people who need to be in charge of that.
Totally. Yeah. I think it's really complicated. Like, some teams, actually increasingly, almost all professional teams and a lot of college teams employ sports psychologists. And Laysha Clarendon actually was one of the people who told me, like, well, we don't always feel comfortable going to the teams. Like, we want to also go outside the teams and just have like money for to be reimbursed for those like hefty medical bills. And it's like, how do you trust the team you're working for to have your best interest in mind?
So all same with like ACLs and stuff, right? Like, they're just, yeah, they the team just wants to roll you out there most cases, right? Who's doing it well?
Which teams?
Yeah, or just like people, like, you know, where is this happening in a way that you, you know, with all your homework, you're like, this is a good model.
I thought the Mavericks actually have a pretty good model where, which is, I guess, both surprising and not. Like, I mean, like, obviously the team culture around the Mavericks leaves a lot to be desired, but also, you know, they invest in things. Don Kalkstein is the guy who has headed up the Mavericks, like, sports psychology department for quite a long time. I think he was the first such person in the league. So he's been around a while, which is part of establishing that culture of, you know, we can talk about this stuff. And I know one of the things he told me was that they also work with players as families. And I'm like, oh, that makes total sense to me. Like, you're looking at like the whole package and not just like one piece of it.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense to me. You know, I wonder, you know, because the athletes that have been that talk about this stuff and who've been sort of the ones you mentioned as like first foremost, we talk about Naomi Osaka, DeMar DeRozan, Kevin Love in the NBA talked about it. I was listening to a podcast recently where an MMA fighter talked about it, which I'm like, wow, in that sport? Because that is just like, you know, if the NBA is caveman in relation to this stuff, MMA is like, what's before caveman? Whatever that is, they're in that region. So to have athletes speak about it, and to the point where they're willing to sort of either push teams or say, no, we need to focus on this and have it in our hands and our control, I think that's meaningful. And I think, you know, hopefully in like the next, I don't know, change of slow 50 years, this model looks a lot better.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard because one of the questions I get asked the most are like, okay, so what are the answers, Julie? Like, what can we do? And it's like, I don't think I have all the answers. I just think we need to keep funneling more money and resources to athletes and also look at the holistic picture, look at coaches' mental health, look at front office staff's mental health, look at, you know, youth athletes' mental health. I mean, that's in a way, that's all we can do is just keep like asking the right questions and offering the right resources.
What, I was interested in the psychedelics mention. Like, I know, like, I've, you know, I'm a Michael Pollan fan. I know that his, like, you know, there's like, it's not, I guess, I don't know where the research is, to be honest, but I know there's like much more research than there used to be about this could like, oh, I see your cat.
Yeah. Let me get out of the way.
Why are you people?
There's a visitor. And there's a little bit of, you said there's one study about the effect of like psychedelics in elite athletes. Like, what do we know about this?
Yeah, I guess we still don't know a ton. We know that a lot of the studies that have been done haven't included elite athletes just because they're such a special population and because athletes are very serious for the most part about what they put into their bodies and when and why. But in non-athlete populations, we have seen some promising effects, especially for conditions like PTSD and depression, with different drugs. You know, they have to be used in the right environments. It's, you know, ideally you're not like going to Peru and doing this on your own. But
you're not Aaron Rodgers or taking ayahuasca in the middle of wherever the hell he does it.
yeah, I would say that's probably, and I did talk to Aaron Rodgers for a Sports Illustrated piece about psychedelic use in athletes. And I was like, so are you using this for mental health? He's like, no.
Sounds about right.
I mean, at the same time, though, he does talk about like how it improved his, you know, feeling. So I'm like, okay, are you sure about that? Like, I don't know. I don't know what's going on with him.
Are we having a hard time using the phrase mental health, Aaron?
Right, yeah. I think we might be. But no, so ideally you're using the drugs in a very controlled environment. You're getting the appropriate therapy. And there was a great Wired story a while back about how the therapy you get with psychedelic use, like say you're using ketamine, for example, to treat depression, you know, that just because you're getting therapy in the room doesn't mean it's like the best available therapy. So I think it's really tricky and we're still learning a lot, but I think researchers are interested in doing more work with elite athlete populations. To go back to MMA, like I think they were interested in doing like a trial with Johns Hopkins, which is one of the leading institutions for research in psychedelics. Now that didn't pan out, but there are some leagues asking the right questions. I don't think you're going to see like a trial of NFL athletes anytime soon, for example, but there's still a lot we don't know. And people are really cautious about saying anything, but yeah, it's certainly an interesting area and it's worth exploring, especially because these are things athletes are already doing in the off season. They're experimenting a little bit. So, but yeah, it's about finding the right conditions.
There's, I'm an NYU alum and like NYU was one of the places that did early research on like cancer diagnosis anxiety. And do you know anything about this? Like they, I this was years ago. I thought it was fascinating, but it's like people would get a terminal cancer diagnosis. It's like, oh my gosh, I have like 4 months to enjoy my family, but they couldn't enjoy their family because they were so anxious about the diagnosis, right? So then this NYU trial is basically just like you're going to do, as you're describing, a controlled environment, like one session of, I think there was like psilocybin in that one. And and then people are like literally like completely, I mean, there were anecdotal reports where the people were just like, this is the greatest thing I ever did. Now I'm like walking on the beach with my family and laughing and having big dinners and like just like enjoying my remaining time. And I was like, that made a bigger impression on me. I'm like, oh, like that's like a, it does feel to me like the reason that I would think about this with athletes is it does seem like a not everybody, but a lot of people become elite athletes by being kind of obsessive. Right. And like, which is a form of anxiety, right? Like, which we know comes with a lot of other, you know,
addiction, and tricky, all sorts of
tricky things in your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seems like, oh, there are probably some people out there that could use some,
for sure,
anxiety therapy.
You know, we always like sport is just it's just this interesting place because it's always used as sort of like a, I always say it's a mirror reflection of society, right? It's a microcosm, but it can also be a leader in things because of the value that we place on it as a society, right?
Right.
So it can be something perhaps that leads the way in this, but you know, it would require people who are within these institutions to have the best interest of the athletes and people in mind. And as Henry knows, that's not really, we don't find a lot of that in these leagues. Not a thing.
No, we certainly don't. Yeah, it's, I don't know. I think it is about, to go back to Shikari Richardson, it is about like the upkeep of this image of the athlete as someone like very heavy air quotes who is respectable, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What about the media here? Like, you know, a lot of these things come up in the workplace and we kind of know how to deal with it a little bit, right? It's like Naomi Osaka as a like manager could get a day off, right? Like if she worked at Kinko's or whatever, right? But she's supposed to be on the mic, right? And like, or Shikari Richardson, same thing, right? Like maybe if they didn't have media there, no one would have to know any of this, right? Like she
could be
someone who runs fast, right? Like, how do we do this right if we're the media, right? Like we want to ask questions about how you win or why you didn't perform well today, but maybe we shouldn't always get answers. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been trying to ask this question of people, especially people in the media, for a few years now, basically since Naomi Osaka bowed out of the French Open. I really want to write an article about like rethinking athlete press conferences. I don't know if anyone has like a great way to reimagine them, but maybe that's interesting too, right? If it's like, we just need to keep doing what we're doing, but I'll be a little more humane about it. I think that's still a decent point. I think, you know, in the media, we shouldn't be friends with athletes, but I think we can maintain a professional distance while still caring about them as people while still making sure our questions in press conferences and elsewhere are intelligent. Because I think we've all seen press conferences where the questions are just like, what are you doing, man? That call in the fourth quarter was stupid, or, you know, like, and it's like, okay, is that even journalism at that point? And so I think we can all be a little more thoughtful. I think we can work with athletes to tell their stories. I think it's really hard in this day and age because of, like, you know, gestures wildly at social media. And also outlets like the Players Tribune, you know, the Players Tribune publishes some really moving stuff, but it's not quite journalism. It's like, exists in this like liminal space, mm-hmm. Between journalism and just like straight PR.
Right.
And so I think it's hard for athlete or for the media to even like win the right to kind of tell athlete stories, whereas the media used to be like the first option. So I think we need to like,
oh, so true. Yeah.
Just increase our credibility however we can. And that's by caring about people.
I think well, you're dead on. This is something that I know that speaks to Henry directly, because he's all about, the way you get to do things is by earning trust, right?
And yeah.
We, not us, but we as the media have done a poor, like, there's none. We have earned zero right now. And that's why that relationship between athlete and media is what it is right now, which is non-existent, right? Unless it's someone getting fluffed something for PR that we just drop out there. And it's like, that's not news. That's not journalism, right? Which, mm-hmm. again, is something that Henry cares about.
Well, I, as you were talking, like, press conferences, to me, like, it's probably mostly useful for like holding powerful people to account, right? So this is like, you know, the White House press corps, like, how dare you invade Beirut or whatever, right? Like, right. I feel like that's right. Kind of like the model. And like, it always felt, I mean, from the first time I was in an NBA like post-game scrum or whatever, I was like, we're going to haul like, mm-hmm. like, who would it be? Like, you know, Eric Snow out here, right. And just like mm-hmm. hurl questions at him about the third quarter. And right. Like, it's so uncomfortable. And not to mention like, stupid in the sense, stupid as a business practice for the media. It's not like what Eric Snow says in that setting does anything for the business. Like, you know, correct. We're not selling right. newspapers with his like pat answers about their, it's just like this weird trial. And like, I quickly noticed, I was like, oh, well, that time Stephen A. Smith was a local columnist, but like, you know, it's like he would walk to the loading dock with mm-hmm. Eric Snow.
That's and then the stuff like, you like, want.
And that was the only interesting conversation anybody had in the building all night, right?
Right.
And I can, so I was like, well, obviously, if you just want to know what's actually happening here, you have to earn trust, right? Like, mm-hmm. and it just feels still exact. Like, you know, I'd be interested to know, who did Sha'Carri Richardson actually tell the real version of events to? Like, it probably wasn't at a press conference. That's a
great
right?
question. I don't think it was. I can't remember off the top of my head who she told, but yeah, that I would love to. Love to have been in that person's shoes, you know, see what they said. And yeah.
You know, we mentioned, you know, what are we entitled to know as journalists? What's the public, as fans, entitled to know? A story that's so interesting to me is currently in the NBA right now, the Andrew Wiggins situation. Played for the Golden State Warriors. So last year, he missed a significant amount of time towards the second half of the regular season. Came back in time for the playoffs, but it was just a family reason. But at first, it wasn't even that. No one knew, and the team wasn't saying. And people were like, you know, well, it's our right to know certain things. And I'm like, but is it? And now he's out again indefinitely. No time when he's going to return, and it's a personal family matter. And to me, I don't think we have a right to know what that personal family matter is. I just right. don't like, I get it. He plays for your favorite team and you're missing an important player, but if his team is fine with it and I don't like, there's nothing that we deserve to know. Now, if there is some media person who has a great relationship and has earned the trust and they can fine, but I doubt that'll ever happen. And I think that's fair, but there is this hankering of like wanting to know. And then it turns into, you guys make $40 million a year. And it's like, but what does that have to do with anything? Why don't you? Why don't you ask the CEO of freaking JP Morgan why he does the shit he does, and he makes $200 million a year? Like, you know totally. What I mean? Like,
yeah, I don't know. It's strange. Depressing. It is? Yeah.
Well, I think like fans have this like totally irrational like we own you mentality, which mm-hmm. is like just, mm-hmm. like that's always wrong. But at the same time, like without that obsession, right? So, you know, like LeBron can sell Kias Does he still have that Kia deal? Is that still going on?
Maybe. Well, the NBA has a Kia deal, that's for sure.
For a while, it was just LeBron and a Kia every time you turn your TV. Like, he can sell Kias because we are obsessed with him even off the court, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so he's reaping the rewards of our weird obsession with his off-court life, right? Like, we care about his children. We care about Taco Tuesday and all this stuff because, like, you know, like, he's... It's part of why he's so... He could be a completely reclusive. He could be like Kareem, right? Mm-hmm. And just like not play that game. He'd make a lot less money, right? But he's like, no, I'm in. Like, so to me, I'm like, yeah, you should expect people to be weird about it, right? Like, they're going to want it selfies at dinner in the restaurant. Like, this is just... Maybe they're wrong to interrupt your dinner, but it's predictable that people are going to do that, right?
Yep.
So that's where I think it's like a little like... It's tough to know like what the... You know, how to draw a line if you're Andrew Wiggins, right? Like a... If I were him, I would be like, I don't know if I would ever do this, but I would be thinking about who is the person in the media with like a big reputation and a lot of trust who you would like lay it out there to, right? And like, and have a one-on-one meaningful, like there's a little hotel fake fire in the back, you know, like this, for some reason you can only have that conversation with a hotel fake
fireside
fire
chat. Love it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what the problem with that is, though, is that sports media is kind of crumbling. Like, I mean,
yeah,
like there's so few outlets for good sports journalism now, and it's like, well, what do you do?
Henry, was that up close and personal with Roy Firestone? Was he the guy on ESPN back in the day? Is he the dude?
Yeah, I mean, that was, he had the fireplace, right? But I've noticed though, still, like, you know, in my time at ESPN, there were moments of like, we need to set up a place for like a big interview, right? And you know, in my mind, that would be like, actually, the coolest was at one point a friend owned a bar in Brooklyn and let us shoot with like that, all the raw brick, and there was like side light sunlight from the side. It looked really cool, and everyone's like, "Ah, it looks kind of like a garage." And I was like, "Meanwhile, like 100% of the time that I was involved with like somebody setting, it was all 100% like, I know we'll get a hotel suite." And like, in my mind, I'm like, when I see the interview, I'm like, "Why are they in a hotel suite?" Like, it just looks so. It's a very strange place to have that conversation. Like,
folks, like,
you guys got a hotel room to talk about sadness? Like, it's just weird. Anyway,
sorry. Mind game. Today. Julie Kligman, if there's one thing you want people to take from the book, Julie, what is it?
I think it would just be like, how cool is it that we can treat athletes as people, and you can take these lessons from athletes and hopefully apply them to your own life. If an athlete can ask for help, so can you.
Well said. Where can the people find you?
They can find me at JM Kligman on social media and in various publications. There's an excerpt of Mind Game on Sports Illustrated's website. It is the hypnotist part.
See? I mean, I read that. I was like, how could people not? This is great. Like, this dude, like, this is awesome. Who wants to do that? Folks, Mind Game, get it wherever books are sold. Julie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.